All right. Good morning, everyone. I thank the organizers for allowing me to participate in this wonderful, thought-provoking workshop. Okay, so here's my disclaimer. So I'm going to explain what I do. So I do clinical practice and then scientific research. As a clinician, I do all sorts of catheter ablations, including atrial fibrillation. This is one of the typical setup for atrial fibrillation ablation. So I'm standing here as an operator, there's a fellow, there's a radiation technologist. So patients are lying like this, there's a pose here. And then in our institution, every patient for atrial fibrillation ablation is intubated under general anesthesia, so they don't move. We can completely control their respiration. And then there's a biplane x-ray machine, and the operator is looking at all those multiple screens with multiple parameters. This is the irrigation catheter system, and then this is a shunt defibrillator. And then all those panels you have, this is a right anterior oblique view from one of the tubes of the biplane x-ray, and this is another, this is the left anterior oblique view. This patient happens to have actually a defibrillator and a pacemaker at the same time. This is a long story, but the history of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy set us for the septal myectomy complicated by complete heart block, had a pacemaker first, and then later defibrillator. Anyway, it happens in some cases. And we're looking at the real-time monitor of a multi-electrode. Usually it's a bipolar electrical signals. And you see that this patient's complete heart block and it's paced in the atrium and paced in the ventricle. And those parameters are for ablation. And then it's a power for ablation, temperature from the tip, and impedance from the tip. And this is the three-dimensional electron anatomical system. You have 3D the shell from the patient CAT scan, which was taken probably in the morning of the procedure. And then it's color-coded in terms of the amplitude of the voltage. So the red region is scar, and the purple region is a healthy myocardium. So you see that there's not much healthy myocardium in this patient. I believe this was a redo case, and then this is at the end of the second ablation procedure. And you have this catheter that Arcadia was talking about. This is a lasso catheter. I don't know if you can see, but it's a ring tip catheter. You can kind of adjust the knob to dilate and shrink the diameter of this ring catheter. And then you have a kind of the vitals over here. This is a real-time ECG. I think this is lead 2. Arterial blood pressure. The patient has an arterial line and a radial artery. This is the respiration. This is the saturation. This is 100% on SAT. This is a temperature from the temperature probe in the esophagus so that we don't burn the esophagus. This is an intracardiac echocardiogram. You're looking at the intra-arterial septum over here. So this is just a convenient before you stick the septum. All right, so this is a typical setup.
Sorry, Arash.
Yes?
The measurements of the heart block, is it amputated or is it, what's the...
The measurement for...
Yeah, the activation.
This one? No, this is the voltage mapping.
So
this
is the structure is inflated.
Oh no, so this is usually you get the shell, the CT shell from either CT scan or MRI of the patient. So you have a perfect geometry, patient specific geometry. And you register it in different ways to the actual patient XYZ coordinates on the bed. And then, so this is actual anatomy, and then of course there's always some level of that registration error, but when you move the catheter, you can see the catheter in this view, in up and down and right and left.
How long it takes to construct that map?
This map, probably 5-10 minutes, depending on the difficulty of anatomy. If it is dilated, of course it takes longer time.
And how do you differentiate between a scar and poor contact of the electrode?
Good point. So it used to be a big challenge, well, at least to some people it was a big challenge, but now we have a force sensing catheter. So this is not available, but at the tip of the catheter, there's a force sensing mechanism. So when you touch the wall, you can get some numbers. It's expressed usually in grams. For example, if it is 0, 1 gram, you're probably not touching anywhere. You're floating somewhere in the chamber. But if you're touching something, as you kind of bend the catheter, it goes up to 5 gram, 10 gram, 15 grams. And then if it goes at that sort of level, like a 20 grams, it's gonna flash in right there and say, oh, you're about to perforate. So there are a lot of safety mechanisms in this stuff.
And how many catheters do you have then?
Depends on the operator. I'm a minimalist. I use a single transseptal, one ablation catheter, and then I use the multi-electrode catheter called a Penarin catheter for a mapping, and an exchange catheter as you move along.
So, but here we have three, or?
Oh, so this is actually because of the devices. For example, if you have pacemaker, this is a this is a dual chamber pacemaker. So you have atrial lead and then ventricular lead. And then you have additional defibrillator, which adds another lead. Right. So there's a lot of hardware, yes. It's very complex. You have to, when you manipulate the catheter, you have to go around those hardware to get to where you want to go. All right. So, and in addition to that, I do some devising for patient, and then I have an outpatient clinic, inpatient consult. And then I also provide scientists with clinical data in various forms of collaborations. This is one way I could be useful to you. So most of the cases, I also provide some intellectual input, but other times I just give out the data to scientists. Another way I could be useful to you is that I could be a source of your second opinion. Based on the statistics, I wouldn't be surprised if there are at least a few people in this room with atrial fibrillation. So if you have typical symptoms like palpitations, fatigue, shortness of breath, lightheadedness, you can come see me. And our conversation will be strictly confidential. So my office is on the second floor. All right. And as a scientist, I'm very interested in fibrillation, the mechanism of fibrillation.
You charge a beer or?
Maybe a cup of coffee. All right, and I do clinical research and quantitative research. For clinical research, I do some outcome research on atrial fibrillation using some advanced imaging, cardiac CT, cardiac MRI. And I'm also interested in idiopathic ventricular fibrillation. This is in collaboration with Michel Hassegger and Bordeaux. So this is a diagnosis of exclusion. This impacts relatively young people, people in the 20s and the 40s, without any structural heart disease. So you do all sorts of studies, like a cardiac MRI, coronary angiogram, provocation in coronary angiogram, and genetic testing. You have to rule out every possible disease known to human beings to make a diagnosis of this. And then there's some progress in the pancreas of idiopathic.
Genetic testing tests for what? For general.
It's usually panel. There's a it's a little bit different between Europe and here. And here there's always kind of reimbursement issues. So but you can't. For example, if you limit the patient population to whoever had a history of avoided sudden cardiac arrest, most insurance companies accept the genetic panel for some any kind of inheritable arrhythmia panel, and also inheritable cardiomyopathy panel. So putting together usually about 130 to 140 genes.
But you make this diagnosis post-mortem or?
Not post-mortem. So you have to make it to the hospital. So that's the issue. So you have to be lucky enough to be resuscitated. In the quantitative research, I do complex system research. I'm interested in phase transition and in causality and in information flow. So that's the topic of the discussion today. So we talked about some of the open questions in this field, and then this is the open questions in the clinical field. What causes fibrillation, and how can we cure fibrillation? So as you may know, the clinical cardiac electrophysiology has become intensively a procedural field. So it's almost like a surgery field. We do a lot of ablations, and we did actually almost cure some simple arrhythmias like supraventricular tachycardias, some WPW syndrome, several things, atrial flutter. But at this point, the fibrillation, we have no clue. So there are some progress in terms of a fibrillation ablation, but we don't really know what's actually causing fibrillation and how to cure it. All right, so just in case I don't get to the last slide. So this is a take-home message. So fibrillation is a macro-scale behavior of a complex system consisting of micro-scale components. And this macro-scale behavior results from two different interaction components, intra-scale and inter-scale interactions. And information theory provides model-free, scale-free metrics to improve the understanding of the fundamental mechanism of fibrillation. By model-free, I mean that you can apply to any models, whatever model of choice, Rudy model, the tentutia model or experimental data or even clinical data. That's the beauty of it. You can apply the unipolar signals or the bipolar signals that we get clinically. Also, scale-free metrics, meaning that you don't really have to stick to one scale, so cellular scale, ion channel scale, cell scale, tissue scale, or organ scale. As a clinician, I'm mostly interested in organ to tissue scale kind of interface, but you can use the same concept to any scales. And also, you can describe, with the information theory, you can describe zero-dimensional and one-dimensional cardiac dynamics in terms of interscale interaction. And in terms of interscale interaction, you can use the information theory to describe the information flow as a surrogate for the mechanism that maintains spiral rate, from your show example. And also, you can determine, or you can quantify the causal scale of fibrillation. All right. So before going to that, I'm going to go over some current clinical paradigm of fibrillation, just to make sure we're on the same page. So there's a substrate, which is very important. What is a substrate? Substrate is a mechanism that promotes arrhythmia, and there are two different substrates, dynamic substrates and structural substrates. In clinical terms, we call it functional substrate and anatomical substrate, but the same thing. So dynamical properties, usually in restitution, condition velocity restitution, AP restitution, and curvature properties and so on, it's purely dynamical or functional. The structural properties or anatomical properties, one of the prominent ones is fibrosis. And in addition to substrate, you need trigger. You need the trigger to initiate arrhythmia. And in the last 2 weeks, we learned a lot about the EADs and DADs, and those end up having like ectopic PAC and PVC. So you need to have a trigger in addition to substrate to cause fibrillation.
Necessarily, so they have a patch of plaque induction initiates that trigger, but that's
the dogma. Yes. And actually, there's another one called a modulator, which is actually autonomic tone, because this modulator impacts the trigger, the higher sympathetic tone, the higher incidence of the trigger, the higher autonomic tone is going to definitely change the dynamic property, and also some destructive properties as well. So in the past 10 years or so, we've been kind of bombarding those, destroying all those triggers and modulators, substrate, to try to target the fibrillation. We made some progress, as I say, but it's not quite there yet. There's a new concept emerging called the driver. We talked a little bit about it in the previous talks. So driver is thought to be the mechanism that maintains arrhythmia. So that's separate from substrate and a trigger. So there's a little bit of controversy about it. Some people actually don't think driver is anything different from trigger or substrate. So depending on who you talk to, and then when you look at the clinical journals, just take a grain of salt. For example, when people talk about driver, you always have to think about those. So what does author mean by driver? Because driver could mean to different things to different people. By literature, and there's no standard term in the literature. But the overall, in general, so the mechanism that maintains arrhythmia could be rotors, multiple wavelets, and or focal activities. There's no answer at this point.
So you think in terms of, from a clinical standpoint, the sort of controversy of whether fibrillation is focal or reentry, that's, if you were to ask the clinical people and take a poll, what would it be? Would it be 50-50, or what do you think the sort of...
For a variety of reasons, the border is actually coming down. If you ask me in 2012, probably this is the most popular answer. But it's going down because of some disappointing results from the border mapping. And the multiple wavelet is still there.
What's the disappointing result? I almost
forgot to say that as well. There's a one technology using the 64 electro basket catheter in the left atrium to map the atrial fibrillation, and then they're using some combination of phase mapping and some kernel to try to visualize the kind of a reentrant activity, the idea is to burn the core of the spiral wave to get rid of it. And the initial studies were very promising. It's called a CONFIRM trial, and it was published in JACC in 2012. It was very, very promising. But the follow-up studies were very disappointing.
I see. For atrial, what about for ventricular, like the idiopathic kind of thing that you're interested in?
electricity?
At this point, there's no, there's not much data. So that's there's a lot of room for research. But at the animal level research, there's interesting reports from the many institutions like the University of Auckland in New Zealand. For example, they were able to recapitulate the fibrillation, and then they proved that the rotors and the multiple wavelets can actually coexist in one organ. So there's the multiple wavelet aspect of a reentry, the functional reentry circuit, at the same time as rotors.
How do you find most of the wavelets? Are there just rotors that appear and disappear, or how do you find most of the wavelets?
So I don't recall the precise the method that they use in the paper, but the so now you just define what the multiple wavelets are and what the rotors are. And then they use several different methods, of course, the phase mapping and then this activation sequence. And then in the end, at the end of the day, you can define some function reentry, which is completely different from rotor activity. All right, so to understand the concept of driver a little bit better, I want to just cite this a classic paper from 1995. So this is a relatively simple setting compared to the current standard. You have a goat in vivo with a pacemaker. And then if you give birth spacing, which is probably half a second or something, the goat goes into atrial fibrillation, but only for 5 seconds, and it spontaneously terminates. But if you do this, the birth spacing followed by some 1 second of a sinus rhythm and the birth spacing again, you just repeat it many, many times for 24 hours. And now you have atrial fibrillation for 20 seconds after cessation of this pacing. If you do this over 2 weeks, and then you stop pacing, and then you're going to have a sustained AFib for over 24 hours. So that's why this is a very classic phenomenon called atrial fibrillation begets atrial fibrillation. So the summary of this is a longer duration of pacing maintained atrial fibrillation results in a longer maintenance of atrial fibrillation after cessation of pacing. So you can make a lot of different interpretation of this data. So one of the interpretation is, it's electrical remodeling. Another interpretation is, it's a short-term memory. And those are not mutually exclusive. Of course, the gene expression is different and whatnot. But this is relatively short-term, so we don't really have to think about the fibrosis and all the things that's mostly related to human being.
Fine channel remodel in a few hours.
In 24 hours.
Well, 24 hours, but right. It's only within 24 hours they can remodel. So.
Right. And I want to add another non-mutually exclusive interpretation to it. So if you look at this, the behavior of each cardiomyocyte causes atrial fibrillation as a collective behavior. So each component, for example, each cell, creates this microscopic behavior. But at the same time, this the atrial fibrillation causes each cardiomyocyte to behave in a certain way. In a sense, it controls or constrains the behavior of each cardiomyocyte. So you can think of it as, you can think of atrial fibrillation as a macroscale behavior of a complex system of the heart. So before going on, I want to just define what the complex system is. There are so many different definitions in the field. So in my mind, it's a networks made of a large number of microscopic components that interact with each other, typically in a nonlinear fashion, that occasionally leads to the emergence of a collective behaviors at the microscopic scales. Okay, and I want to give you some examples like this. So this is a probably easy to understand example of complex system, the Fokker birds. So each bird creates this flock. But the dynamics of the flock determines or constrains the dynamics of each bird in a certain way. And if you think about the dynamics of each bird, it's relatively simple, right? But it's, and compared to that simple dynamics, that the collective dynamics of flock is, it's really incredible. It's really hard to imagine from individual dynamics. A similar example, school fish. Each fish, I don't think each fish is very, very smart, but when they get together, it's very, very beautiful, very profound dynamics, collective dynamics. Again, in this case, the each fish creates, contributes to the collective dynamics, but also collective dynamics constrains or controls the individual dynamics. Another example, synchronization of fireflies. You have thousands and thousands of fireflies blink in sync. So again, each individual firefly creates the microscopic collective behavior, but a collective behavior because it tells each firefly to blink in a certain way. So in simplistic terms, so this is a complex system, and then you can observe system behavior in a different scales, and it's called a system scale separation. So at the microscopic scale, but this is a pretty arbitrary scale separation. I just show it at two scales, macroscopic and the microscopic, but it tends to be the multi-scale structure. So at the microscopic scale, you have individual dynamics of individual components, which is relatively simple rules of operation. And then there's some interaction between components. I call it intra-scale interaction. That leads to some kind of a collective microscopic behavior. And then there's an interaction between the scale, macroscopic scale and a microscopic scale, I call it inter-scale interaction. So you can think of fibrillation as a macroscale behavior of the system. And then, for example, fibrillation is a macroscopic collective behavior that determines the dynamics of individual components. Individual components could be cardiomyocytes, could be tissue regions, because again, that's the scale that I'm interested in. But if you can go down to, you know, this subcellular level and calcium channel, you can do that as well. So if you think about what the driver is, this is actually a driver. Driver is mechanism that maintains fibrillation. So that's a macroscale collective behavior determines or constrains the behavior of individual components. And the current therapeutic intervention is here, drugs, ablation. We're trying to intervene on this, but actually this is not really our target. We're gonna target actually this to change the collective behavior of the system. And then we have drugs and ablation. And in my mind, the only reason that ablation performs better than drugs is that for ablation, you can do selective intervention. For example, if you use drug, it's gonna impact all the components in the system. So that's why it's either ineffective or kill people. All right, so how can we quantify intra-scale interaction? I'm gonna talk about intra-scale interaction and inter-scale interaction. And then I drew a lot of examples from neuroscience. And then it's been worked on in neuroscience for a couple of decades. So you can think of a communication between components as a surrogate for intra-scale interaction. So let's think about the communication between Arya Stark and Bran Stark. So Arya Stark wants to send a very important message to Bran Stark. But of course, she doesn't want other families like Lannisters to know what the message is about. So she encrypts the message using some kind of code and then put it on a raven and just send it to Bran. But it turns out that this raven is not really reliable. You know, it could be intercepted, it could lose part of the code. But eventually, when Bran receives this message, he's going to decrypt the message into some message and he understands the message. But in this kind of situation, how can you quantify communication between Arya Stark and Bran Stark? Well, this riddle was solved by the American mathematician Claude Shannon in 1948. He developed several different metrics to calculate the communication, such as the mutual information, which is the information shared between X and Y, which is shown in IXY. And the channel capacity is the maximum information the given channel allows X and Y to share. This is actually the function of the raven. It's not about the communication between Arya and Bran, but actually the function of raven in this example. And transfer entropy, this is not the invention of Claude Shannon, but actually it was invented by Tom Shriver at the Max Planck Institute in Dresden. It's the information transfer from X to Y. So those three concepts are very important. It's kind of the three basic concepts in information theory. So since those are very important concepts in explaining my studies, I'm going to take a little time to just explain what those are. So before going to the communication, I'm going to explain what the Shannon entropy is. Shannon entropy in the sense that this is in classical information theory. It's not a quantum information theory, although I'm very interested in quantum information theory. So it's not a thermodynamic entropy, although many people think that the Shannon entropy and the thermodynamic entropy are essentially equivalent. Anyway, so let's calculate the Shannon entropy of a cardiomyocyte. You have this, a kind of a typical single-cell experiment. You stick a needle in the cardiomyocyte and it pays at the constant basic cycle length S1. And you have a nice AP alternance, short, long, short, long. And you can binarize this time series into zeros and ones. For example, I usually use APD90 as a kind of a cutoff. If the action potential is above APD90, it's excited, one. If it is below APD90, it's resting, zero. So you can convert this time series into a bunch of the binary strings of zeros and ones. So in that case, The channel entropy of X quantifies the average uncertainty of whether a single cell is either excited, X equals 1, or resting, X equals 0, over its time history. So essentially, it is a macro state of a single cell in a statistical mechanics. So each time point, 0 or 1, that's a micro state. And then the entropy or channel entropy of a single cell is a macro state of a single cell in this given finite time series. So let's calculate it. So for example, you can just count the number of ones over here. There are 30 time points over here. So this is denominator 30. And the number of one is, actually there are 16. You can count them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and whatnot. So P of x equals 1 is 16 over 30, which is 8 over 15. And P of x equals 0 is 1 minus P of x equals 1. So it's a 7 over 15 because it's a binary data. But you can easily expand it to any kind of continuous variables. So this is the definition of the Shannon entropy. It's a minus sigma over x, so px times log 2px. So there are two cases, x equals 0 versus x equals 1. Calculate it, and just plug in those numbers, no big deal. So the Shannon entropy, or macro state of this time series of the single cell, is 0.9968 bits.
That's per one digit, not the whole message.
No, this is a whole message. Because this is
less than one bit for the whole message.
Oh, that's a wrong thing for the whole message, yes. Because it's average uncertainty, average probability. Well, average uncertainty because it's probability times local probability.
Average.
Average, yes. Yes, average over this time history.
So how do you define how long you want to do your time history?
You can define anything.
That would change.
As long as you want. Well, again, yes. For example, you can just define it in practical sense. You can define it up there at each pacing, for example, pacing protocol. For example, S1, and they just you just record it for 10 seconds, 100 seconds, you name it. And then just in under the same setting, you can record it, record the same or number of beats, for example. But you can define it anyway because it's average.
So what about period one? Different.
I'll get to that. Yes. All right, very good. So let's describe zero-dimensional cardiac dynamics using this information theory. Probably top two roles are very familiar. And actually, this is a model by Flavio from his 1998 paper. And then, the parameter set is a parameter set 6 of the paper in Chaos by Flavio and Elizabeth in 2002. So when the basic cycle length is 300 milliseconds, you have this APD restitution curve. X-axis is diastolic interval, y-axis APD, and it nicely converge into nice one point. When the basic cycle length is 240 milliseconds, you have a very typical APD alternance. It has a long, short, long, short, long, short. And when the basic cycle length is 200 milliseconds, it goes to this, and then the slope is greater than 1, and it's an unstable fixed point. So it becomes refractory. So it goes to basically 2 to 1 response. So if you enlarge this point here, so that's the interval versus APD, and this is basic cycle length versus APD. So this is just an enlargement of the APD restitution with the same x-axis of diastolic interval. This is the x-axis now basic cycle length, and it shows a nice bifurcation. And then bifurcation, the long and short differs by 100 milliseconds, relatively large, but you can blame Flavio for this. Anyway, so it's a nice bifurcation, but this is one of the examples. And then what happens if you just change the y-axis to the Shannon entropy? So I've started with the basic cycle length. It's the same scale with this one. So 300 milliseconds, 280 minutes, and 260 milliseconds. It goes down smoothly, very nicely, smoothly. And then there's nothing happening at the bifurcation. So it answers part of your question. So it's not, in terms of macro state, it doesn't change. I mean, the bifurcation has almost no impact on the macro state of the individual cardiomyocyte. But as opposed to basic cycle lengths, because now you have one basic cycle length and two APD and two DI. So and each if it's below bifurcation, you have two you can have a two channel entropy. So it bifurcates in this direction. Anyway, but the message over here is that the bifurcation in terms of the Shannon entropy doesn't really have much impact on the macro state.
So why am I interested in looking at that?
No, this is just an example.
Okay. So period two have the role in interpreting period one.
Pier 2, well, I mean, you're talking about this decline. Now, this is like a simple, probably simple map. So, I said that the so this is a definition of Shum and debris. And then if P equals zero, let's just define as P, then X equals Y becomes 1 minus B in a binary case. So in this kind of system, you can define Shannon entropy as minus P stroke P minus 1 minus B stroke 2 1 minus B. So what kind of function is this? So if you plot it, right, you can see it from there. You see this? All right, so there's a P and there is an X. It peaks up to 1 over 2 as 1 bit. So just to think about the optimization of the Shannon entropy. So what happens, how can you maximize the Shannon entropy when the P equals 2, 1 over 2? If it is 0.5, it's maximized. And then when you pace faster and faster, essentially you're making more ones than zeros. So you're going away from this half, 50% zero and 50% one. So you have more ones than zeros. So that's why it's declining over time. Declining over basic cycle length. Yes?
So, I'm not an expert on Shannon entropy, but I know that it was developed to try to understand how much information can be transmitted along telephone channels or whatever. So in the example that you give, there are different codings that you can have because
it, absolutely,
which would make it much, much more efficient to transmit that signal. So I thought that that was taken into account by the Shannon entropy, but evidently you need it. It's not really present in the Shannon entropy as you're defining it.
Right.
Entropy that takes account of the code.
It's homography.
Right. So the concept of Shannon entropy is necessary to understand the next step, which is communication. But
so that's where you are.
Yes, and also you're right. It's originally developed to try to answer the question. So how much information can we transmit in a noisy channel with a noisy time frame. But we were trying to take advantage of it as a way to quantify communication. Yes, but you're absolutely right. All right, so let's expand it to one dimension. So now we're talking about mutual information between two cardiomyocytes. So we have a cardiomyocyte X over here, and you have a cable of my cardiomyocyte. This is cardiomyocyte Y. You have a series of cardiomyocytes. You can have the X and Y could be directly adjacent to each other, or it could be separated by a number of cardiomyocytes. And the cardiomyocyte has the same dynamics over here, short, long, with a fixed basic cycle length. And the cardiomyocyte Y has actually discordant alternates over here, long, short. But keep in mind that I'm ignoring the connection time. So you're looking at the beat by beat comparison. So this beat corresponds to this beat. This beat corresponds to this beat, which is easy thing to do. So short, long, and long, short, and you can dichotomize or binarize it in the same way. In this case, the mutual information quantifies the information shared between X and Y. So in the Venn diagram over here, so this is the entropy of the X, and this is the entropy of Y, and this is the mutual information, the information shared between X and Y. And then this, the whole thing, the entropy X and entropy Y, so this is called a joint entropy and defined as this. So minus P on a signal X, X over XY, PXY log 2 PXY. And there are four combinations, X0, Y0, X1, Y0, X0, Y1, X1, Y1. And then when you calculate this, IX1 is defined like this, HX plus HY minus HXY. So this is like a simple Venn diagram. So you just add this and this and just subtract the whole thing and you get this. So that's the definition of mutual information. And let's calculate it. So the same thing, P of x equals 1 is 8 over 15. P of x equals 0 is 7 over 15. P of y equals 1 is 8 over 15. And that's actually the same. P of y equals 0 is 7 over 15. And you also calculate the joint probability distribution of four combinations, y0, x0, x1, y0, x0, y1, x1, y1. And you just plug in those numbers. And you get 0.1613. So if you think that this is a macro state or Shannon entropy of this is a 0.99, and this is actually information shared between x and y, and that's because of discordant alternates. And I'll look at that in more detail in the next slide. Oh, that's it now. So I'm going to talk about the channel capacity first. So channel capacity is C between two polymyocytes. And again, that quantifies the maximum information the given channel allows X and Y to share. Again, this is a function of the channel. It's not its own channel. So don't get confused. So for example, if the cardiomyocyte X and Y are immediately adjacent to each other, you can think of it as some kind of function of the intercalated disk. But if X and Y are separated by, you know, dozens of cardiomyocytes, you can think of the whole thing between cardiomyocyte X and Y as a one channel. And you can quantify the function of the channel as an aggregate. All right, and there's an analytical solution and then a numerical solution. And then I derived this solution in my papers. If you're interested, you can look at that. But it's a little bit involved in takes time, so I'm not going too much into this. But briefly, you're going to have to define what kind of channel you're talking about. And I define this channel as a binary asymmetrical channel, which is the most general form of binary discrete memoryless channel. And then, for example, in an ideal world, 0 is transmitted as 0, 1 is transmitted as 1, but there is some portion of probability error. So there's a type 0 error where epsilon naught, the 0 is transmitted as 1. There is a type 1 error where the 1 is transmitted as 0. And you can incorporate all this, and then this is the answer. The channel capacity is described in this equation, and where H is a binary entropy function, which is this. I showed you. So P is the probability of X equals 0 or X equals 1, and Z is this. All right, and you can plug in those numbers. And then epsilon naught is actually the conditional probability when x equals 0, p of y equals 1 given x equals 0. And epsilon 1 is p of y equals 0 given x equals 1, and so on and so on. And you plug in all this number, and then channel capacity is 0.1619, which is only slightly higher than the neutral information, meaning that in this kind of communication, you're almost maximally using the capacity of a channel to communicate with each other. And there's a numerical solution algorithm that exists. It's called a Blackwood-Arimoto algorithm, and you get the same answer using the numerical algorithm. All right, so transfer entropy T from cardiomyocyte X to Y. So this quantifies information transfer from X to Y. So how much information, how much uncertainty X will reduce about Y. So that's actually the definition of the transfer entropy. And then, this is a little bit more involved, so I'm not going to go into details, but you can calculate each of this in this example, and then you get the answer. This is the definition of transfer entropy. But the short message is that you can quantify the information transfer from X to Y using this, which is 0.1323 bits. All right, so let's describe 1D cryodynamics using information theory. So again, the first row is probably something you're familiar with. So this is the basic cycle length of 300 milliseconds. And y-axis or the horizontal axis is time. And the vertical axis is the cable length from x equals 0 to x equals 40 centimeters. It's a relatively large arc. I need to make it large in order to get the concordant alternates. Research as a concordant alternates in here. Anyway, so you're pacing at the x equals 0, and you're looking at the behavior. You're looking at the communication between the pacing site and everybody else over here. So for example, here, this is the first beat, second beat, third beat, and that's transmitted very nicely in here, and here, and here, and here. So that's a normal conduction. When you maybe make the basic cycle a little bit tighter, you're going to have alternates. So this is immediately close to the pacing site. You have a long, short, long, short. And you have a nodal behavior somewhere along the way. Then you have discordant openness. Short, long, short, long. And you have another node behavior over here. And then you eventually get the concordant openness. Long, short, long, short. Here, you're going to you're going to make the basic cycles even tighter, 208 milliseconds. You're going to start with EP openness, long, short, long, short, and you're going to get very quickly get the discordant openness. This is short, long, short, long, and you're going to block. And this block happens around the 10 signature over here. And after the block, it's going to become 2-to-1 production. And you can make it even tighter, basic cycles of 200 milliseconds. You're going to immediately get the 2-to-1 response. This is looking at the communication between the component immediately adjacent to patient site and everybody else. All right, so let's look at the information theory parameters. So for E, for example, this green is a channel entropy, red is a channel capacity, blue is a mutual information. And blue, the mutual information, this is the most interesting one. So the blue mutual information, the communication between the patient site and everything else is pretty high. It's close to 1 bit, and almost close to Shannon entropy.
What do you mean everything else?
Everything else meaning that, for example, x-axis is a cable length. For example, you're comparing your quantified communication with a patient site and, for example, here, this location, component this location, for example.
At which location?
Each location, for example. If you're interested in that component at the 10
centimeters. So is it the same at each location, or you're averaging over all locations?
No. You're calculating at each location.
What?
You're calculating each index at each location.
And then this is the average?
It's not the average. So you have a time series at each location. This is a one-dimensional model, right? So you have a time series at each location. And then you just compare time series at the patient site, and then whatever location that you're interested in. And
so
you get the one.
You're plotting it for a particular location?
Yeah, each particular location for this.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
What about the in alternates? So in alternates, the channel entropy and the channel capacity goes down very nicely. It gradually goes down to zero at 10 centimeters. So this is the component where discordant alternance begins, and then the channel entropy and the channel capacity and mutual information stays low until concordant alternance comes up. So you can actually describe this dynamics using this, and you can just look at it as a profile to understand discordant alternance, the communication between discordant alternance and concordant alternance. When the conduction block occurs, those two metrics actually goes down to zero, and then it stays very, very, very low, of course, because if you compare the communication between this site, this is completely different. And then in the case of two-to-one response, it almost goes flat at about the half level.
So Hiroshi, to me it's sort of confusing that it almost seems like in the discordant alternance case that you're kind of creating information. So, I mean, information gets destroyed as you go from, from the beginning of the fiber into the middle, and your information almost goes to zero. But then it comes back up again. It's like it's been created out of nothing. So somehow it seems like once information is destroyed, then it's gone, right? It doesn't seem like it should ever be able to come up again.
Well, just to keep in mind that this is only look at the two-point the information sharing.
Yeah, so I'm wondering it's almost like it's more like a correlation function. You're just sort of, instead of following information, as it flows, it's more like you're just
getting correlations. Yeah, you can think of it as a kind of a, you can look at a correlation function looking at the statistical dependence of two different random variables. Yes?
So is there some sense in which you understand this? You're just sort of skipping over the middle of the fiber when you go from the beginning to the end. But somehow the information is actually traveling through the fiber, right? So
the information in this sense is of this basic uncertainty, not the sense of the information in the everyday world.
Okay.
So because of what we're seeing is of the how much information we're sharing in two different locations. So it's not like this is generating any information. You're looking for how much is it shared between those two different points, and they're not. And it's not quite like, for example, generation information. But the good point is that, for example, if you think about the if you think about this the original diagram of noise versus the message sender and receiver, you can think of it as the noise level changes. depending on where you are. So that determines this communication and conversation decline, also the actual resurgence of the information. Yeah.
I think there is another issue. So you would think that when in the region, let's say between roughly 10 and 25, there is no information transferred, which is really...
No, this is the information shared. Or it's not information transferred. So those are different.
I mean, there is perfect correlation between the phase of, you know, one signal and another signal. And, you know, if you just look at this metric, basically all that completely disappears. So I think the interpretation of what we're seeing is sort of very non-trivial here.
I don't agree with that. So this is just one way to quantify, again, 2 points, right? And again, I don't know how best to explain this. But we have a kind of a, the location-dependent functional property. So you can think of it as a kind of one way to quantify this location-dependent functional property of the cardiac myocyte. And then depending on the functional property, you know, the information that you share with the original, the cardiomyocyte X changes.
So, I mean, I have a somewhat easier way to understand the third figure. So, for instance, if you have standing nodes, then if you're sitting at the location of the node, you basically don't see anything, right? You don't really understand how this issue in the left or the right in your case. And in that sense, I really see that, you know, there's zero mutual information. Okay, for instance, if you have the discordant alternance, zero doesn't mean it's the same.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. So actually, that's what I think is interesting in the cardiomyocyte, for example. If you think about this has been done in the computational neuroscience a lot, and then they look at the kind of a network structure of the brain, and how that relates to the functional property of the brain and the higher function. But in cardiomyocyte, this dynamic property changes a lot depending on location, depending on several different parameters. And then that creates a very different behavior in terms of information transmission. So this is very particular, this is something particular about the cardiomyocyte. And then I completely understand that, yeah, kind of a non-intuitive the aspect of this.
But I think there's sort of another aspect, sort of how do you encode what the signal is really makes all the difference, right?
Exactly.
You
so
think about, for instance, the stuff that a few days ago, like last week, we talked about response functions, right? So response functions also quantify information flow, but this is small perturbations on top of, you know, some signal. Or you can say, well, you know, if I have everything in rest state and I generate an action potential and generate a wave that starts propagating, that is describing information flow in a completely different sense, and these properties are completely different. Right?
In this example, I just made it very simple, make it binary. So that's the easiest way to understand it. You don't usually get the binary data, I mean, unless, you know, you're working on models or experimental and optical mapping or not. But the idea is that you can apply this to any signals. Again, unipolar signal, bipolar signal, and then this is a binary discrete time series. But it can apply to a continuous time series, continuous random variables. So again, you just have to expand this binary probability distribution to kind of histogram of probability distribution, and you can do the same calculation. So that's one of the strengths of it, because you can just get the same idea, and then you can test it in the model and apply to, for example, clinical data, which is going to show a little bit later. Yeah.
So Hiroshi, I'm wondering whether you perhaps looked at this, and there's different ways that, you know, information can be present in a signal. Have you looked at perhaps other ways of grouping together, you know, different buckets that you're considering to be your sample space for doing the probability calculation? Information might be hiding in another form of organization in the fiber. Other than just looking at the buckets that you're hiding things right now, and it's being just the time series in each point.
Yes, you can do it in all sorts of ways, and then this is just one of the example to how to interrogate, how to just obtain information. And then, for example, again, this is just an example of the voltage, right? But you can apply to, you know, calcium dynamics. You can apply to, you know, potassium, whatever. But the idea is essentially the same, because we're interested in this communication.
For example, there's organization, and if you believe the APDDI conduction velocity model for why you get discordant alternands, then those are rules that tell you, you know, what the AUDs and DIs are going to be at different points in the fiber. And then, you know, those rules then pull you away from just a random distribution of these joint probabilities. And so if you take that into account in the bins that you use to, you know, to do your probability calculation, then it seems like then that would quantify the information flow more according to what's actually happening. And then
let's
maybe
see where you're going, which is,
okay.
Before we go too much into, so far it's, you know, about how useful will it be, that let's see.
Okay.
We can go back to worry about
it. This is something about, so what about time? Like, how do you correct for time delay?
Oh, so actually, so in this case, this is cable experiment. So if you have 1D, you can look at the same beat over time. So I just subtract the time delay and then look at the same beat.
Okay.
But if, for example, if you're looking at the two-dimensional and three-dimensional complex arrhythmia, it's really very difficult. All right. So coming back to this, so now you know something about the information theory. So again, I'm more interested in interstellar interaction because we talked about the driver coming from you know, the macroscale collective behavior to individual dynamics. So this is what I'm interested in. So I looked at the literature, and then there's several different ways to create some series of the scales. For example, we have some given scale. For example, as a clinician, I have only tissue scale or organ scale information. So how can you actually recapitulate the different scales out of those? Or models, for example, you have some 2D grid, a 3D grid of a model. And then the traditional biology way of thinking is that the whole scales, tissue, cell, ion channel, protein, genes, but the that's kind of a kind of traditional thinking. I just didn't want to go through the kind of the same kind of thinking. So just looking at the heart or the model, whatever you have, as some kind of a field. And you can use the minimalization group to create some kind of a series of different scales of the system. So what is the minimalization group? So this is to build a multi-scale description complex system. It's pretty simple. And the concept is pretty simple. Of course, you know, it involves a lot of different calculations there. Just think about this 6x6 grid, and each component has a length scale of d by d, and then each square has a different dynamics, independent dynamics. So how can you create a little bit of macro scale description of this system, and then you can do that by a combination of coarse graining and rescaling. So coarse graining, you can do that with either decimation, majority rule, or averaging. For example, in this case, you just pick up the top left corner of a square over here, and let it represent as a 2x2 immediate adjacent to 2x2 matrix, and rescale by 2D by 2D. So, and it's just repeated many times to create a series of multi-scale structures. And then, don't you think that this procedure is very similar to a very commonly done computer science procedure these days? Yes, of course. Of course, you know. And?
I keep my comments to the end.
Anyway, so this is essentially the same as the convolutional neural network. Which is a key technology of deep learning. So to me, what is similar is actually a fundamental thing. Anyway, so just so you can understand this.
It's renormalization group, it's using phase transition where you have a critical point with diverging correlation lengths.
Mm-hmm.
There's been measurements of correlation lengths during fibrillation. Voltage, and it's a finite correlation length,
mm-hmm.
few millimeters. So, why is, well, I mean, I guess if you want to apply for fibrillations, why the renormalization group? I don't really see the rationale for using it.
Well, again, this is just a one way to create the one objective way to create the series of the multiscale structure of a given system.
I understand, but it's been used. Very near a critical point with diverging correlation lines.
Yes.
I don't see that.
Probably it's the same question, but just in different words. To me, a group is a set of transformations which can be used again and again and again. And there's a renormalization group, and to have anything correlation length, and I think, as a theory, you have to do this. be able to do this rescaling many times, mm-hmm. in theory, infinitely many times. Question is, when thinking in these terms about information, are you going to use it in many times, or it's just once?
Just a finite times. So finite number of times. Yes, in
more
theory,
than
yes,
once.
More than once, because we're dealing with several different scales, but the above the cellular scale. So, for example, in the clinical sense, because we need to develop something that could be applicable to clinical data analysis. And then in clinical, you cannot really go down to the cell level, of course. But you have some given finite number of sensors and a scale. And then the question is, how can we go down? And then this is just provides one of the methods to us to take advantage of this.
Also following that step, I mean, when you have a randomization group, you have a function that brings you from one to the next. Mm-hmm. So you got to create a function that's going to give the same solutions.
Well, so you have you already have a data which is given. And then you just have in a coarse grained data.
Right, but a group would imply a function that you got to generate.
Yeah,
otherwise you just only.
You have to. Yes, that's in a sense you have to. But the actually, so that's not what I did. So this is.
So you just only rescaling.
It's a coarse grain and a rescale. Yes.
So maybe just don't call it your normalization group, just call it, you know, multi scale.
Yeah, because
it's just coarse grain.
You can get and whenever I describe it in a paper, I'd be very careful. It's a combination of coarse graining and rescaling. And then actually, yeah, right, some reviewers in Mega were not very happy, but that's how I define it as a normalization group, the combination of transformation consisting of coarse graining and rescaling. All right. Okay, so to understand it better, I have this example, 300 by 308 pixels by Escher. And then you have, you can just, just to reduce the information, you can just make it by binary pixels. And then by the simple guesstimation, you can make it like this. This is 150 by 150 binary pixels. So that's scale 2. And this is scale 3, 75 by 75. And 37 by 37, scale 4. And 18 by 18 binary pixel, scale 5, and so on. And you can do this. And I did the same thing with the SUM20 model. This is the fixed-field Nagumo model, starting from scale 1 to scale 5. Again, this is the final number of the models. Scale 1 is starting from 120 by 128. It's about 10 seconds. By just averaging the 2x2, the adjacent regions, and we create the next scale. So this is 64 by 64, 32 by 32, 60 by 60, and 8 by 8. And then, this manuscript was reviewed by 3 reviewers, I'll get to the information theory part in a moment. But the first reviewer loved it, second reviewer hated it, and the third reviewer turns out to be Gil, and it made a very profound suggestion, which is to, I'm going to get to the results soon, but the it's great, but the, you're going to have to you're going to have to use the negative control. Make sure that the impact, the result that you're seeing is specific or intrinsic to the renormalization method or coarse graining method that you're using, which is an excellent suggestion. So, and then the editor, and we have some conversation with the editor, and the editor said, okay, why don't you just do the random dynamics? This is the same thing, and see what happens. So this is an example of random dynamics with the same grid size, 120 by 128. So each component of this 120 and 128 is a uniform distribution, random distribution of between 0 and 1, and for the same duration of this one. And then we're going to apply the same scheme. And then eventually what I'm calculating here is that the transfer entropy upward and downward, for example, between scale 1 and scale 2, for example, 1 to 2 versus 2 to 1, so that's downward. 1 to 2 is upward, 2 to 1 is downward. 2 to 3, and 3 to 2, 3 to 4, 4 to 3, 4 to 5, and 5 to 4. Right. So this interscale information flow, the spiral waves. So this is the one example spiral waves, and then this is a microscopic direction, and this is a microscopic direction, and scale 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5. This number represents the average, the whole grid, 120 by 128 over here. So 0.5, 0.48, 0.46, 0.46. And it looks like it's coming down. And a downward information flow is from, for example, 5 to 4, 0.31, 0.38, 0.46, 0.49. So overall, looks like the transfer information, upward information flow goes down as you go macroscopic. And downward information flow looks a little bit lower than upward information flow, and it still goes down as you go more macroscopic. So I was not certain at this point, so I repeated the experiment for 1,000 times with a different initial conditions. So I generated the same, basically the same equations, but the change is the initial condition a little bit for 1,000 times. And it created several different, 1,000 different behavior of the same system. And look at the statistics. So, this is the problem summary. So this is a number of rotors in x-axis, and the probability is y-axis. So the under 1,000 repetitive experiments, you have the rotor, the number of rotor distribution between 0 and 7, with peak is around 3 rotors. And then this is the average of upward and downward information, upward and downward, the transfer entropy. So blue, for example, as you go up the scale, it goes down a little bit. And then the downward information, the transfer information, goes down significantly, also significantly compared to the baseline, also compared to the upper transfer entropy. And then what I was interested in is actually a correlation between a number of rotors and an information flow, the mean transfer entropy. And this is a plot of the 1,000 points. So each point is the average of the transfer entropy in the whole grid. So this is scale 1 versus 2, upward and downward. This is a scale 2 to 3, upward and downward. Scale 3 to 4, upward and downward. And a scale 4 to 5, upward and downward. And look at the association between the number of rotors and the mean transfer entropy. And then it turns out that it's significant. Everything is significantly correlated. So for example, the upper information transfer information is significantly associated with the number of rotors in between scale 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 3 and 4, and 4 and 5. But the correlation, the coefficient R is positive initially, but it comes to negative as you go macro, meaning that the more rotors you have, less information flow you have. So it means that the simplest clinical paradigm is that if you have a rotor, just get rid of a rotor, and it's going to go away. The extrapolation is going away, meaning that the more rotors you have to have more information flow. Because you have a more downward driver kind of a causation coming from the macroscopic behavior to microscopic behavior. But that does not seem to be the case. So that raises a question. So what is actually driving what? So rotor may have nothing to do with this is a kind of the mechanism as a driver. And this is, again, so this is according to Gill's suggestion. I created the same thing using the random dynamics, and then it showed that there's the information flow in NATS, it's almost flat, so it doesn't change. Yes.
Can you just remind me what is the reference? So what is the x and the y for the 2D case? Is it an image? Is it a frame? Or is it force at a pixel compared to time forces at other pixels? I'm just confused as to how you're.
It's a time series. Goes. A time series of the excitation variable and fifth dimensional equations.
Instead of doing the control being on random points, supposing you took a picture of the room and then you did that, the same computation going upward and downward, what would you find?
I haven't done that.
but wouldn't it be about the same that you had with the rotors?
No, so that was one of the questions that Gil had. But the editor thinks that this is the unbiased way of doing this. So that's why we did it. And then actually, I haven't done that. And then just to give you a little bit insight. So initially I thought that I was going to use the Eisen model. So you have a time series of Eisen model. And then and then everybody loves Eisen model. So, and then I try to do the same thing as Eisen model time series. But actually, it turns out that the information flow went up as you go more macro scale. So it does not really go down. There is some situation where actually information flow goes up as you go more macro scale. So I didn't quite have a nice interpretation, so that's why I got rid of it, and you just end up using the random dynamics.
But if you go back to the last slide, you kind of went over it. So you say this finding contradicts the concept that rotors are the causal mechanism that maintains spiral waves.
Right.
So many of us use rotors and spiral waves to be synonymous. I understand that you're thinking of the rotor as kind of the central core.
Right, so definition of the rotor, I didn't...
At the center of the rotor. But I don't understand. Clearly the spiral wave is being generated by what's happening at the center. So I don't understand how you can conclude.
Yeah, but
I don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah, so first of all, the definition of rotor here is that, as you said, it's a phase singularity of the spiral wave. And then the spiral wave is this, you know, that's the whole thing, the spiral waves. And then, it's very counterintuitive. Just to think of this rotor and a spiral wave. If you get rid of the rotors, what's going to happen to the spiral waves? So it's very counterintuitive, the result. But I'll get to a little bit in the next data. Are we okay with the distinction between rotors and spiral waves?
No.
We're not.
I don't understand.
Okay.
Are they the same?
No.
You need a bunch of target patterns.
So a rotor can be functional reentry or anatomic reentry. But there's a singularity point at the tip of a spiral wave, right?
So this is a wave, and then this is a spiral wave, the whole thing. And this is a rotor, and this is a core.
So that's the rotor.
Core, and this is a rotor.
So the rotor is the core.
So that's no. So this is a rotor, and which tends to go around a core, and a core could be, you know, this way. It could be under this way, or
tip of the spiral. Is that
what tip of the spiral. Yeah. So that's what I mean by rotor.
So the rotor is the tip of the spiral.
All right, so
you know the spiral tip is part of the solution to equations. It's a whole solution. This tip and the wave, it's all, you know, they all interact with diffusive coupling. You know, what does causality mean? I mean, I guess in the definition of information theory, I guess I don't understand how useful this is. But maybe we'll get to it.
Just
a comment, because you want to link the concept of rotors to your clinical practice where you have blades, right?
Kind of, yes. But it was a negative. The negative result, meaning that it was not used to go it. There's some aspect, a practical aspect. For example, how do you get rid of it? Because usually when you do ablation, transitional kind of ablation, you create some kind of anatomical scar somewhere. So it's just turning some functional reentry, anatomical reentry, and it doesn't really solve the problem.
So can you go back to slide?
That's a separate issue from...
Yeah. Okay, so, or even like one more back, so in terms of resolution and the size of your rotor, right? How many, let's call it, pixels a single rotor covers?
Meaning a tip?
A tip, yes.
Well, depending on how you define it, because, for example, I define it as a phase singularity. So if you define it as phase singularity, it's a one point.
One point. And then by doing the decimation, then information is getting, it's going to be lost.
Oh, decimation, yes. Decimation has nothing to do with a tip because, for example, it's just one of the components of the whole grid, right? When you do decimation, you decimate according to the preset rule. So you know the number of rotors from the scale one, from the original scale. So that's kind of given. And then a decimation process is completely separate from the number of rotors, for example. For example, as you go, as you go more macro scale, you cannot really understand a rotor in the image, right? Right. So you're not that's not what we're doing. We're not counting number of rotors in the macro scale.
I didn't understand how you go from macro scale back to microscale.
Oh, so this is just a calculating the information flow. For example, looking at the pick each one point over here, and you have a time series of finite amount. And you have, for example, the same crustinging point over here in a buffer scale, and you have a time series. And then you just calculate the transfer entropy from here to here, from macro to micro.
Because if you average, then the information is lost, sort of color. So you can calculate something for each pixel in the kind of lower scale, but it won't be related to what you had before. Because I don't see how you can go from kind of, if you lose information already, when you get to the resolution, so how you can get back? Can we reconstruct
anything? That's not an example. So again, don't get stuck on, don't hang out on the information, because again, we're talking about the uncertainty here.
Yeah, so, information is the wrong word.
Yeah.
Why you confuse.
Okay.
It's a matter of complexity.
All right, so let me just go through this. So again, the result of the previous slide, so transfer entropy or information flow does not really prove or does not really support the notion that the rotors actually rotors are the drivers. So that's a kind of a short statement. So what is driving what? What is driving the whole thing? So and again, I looked at the literature in neuroscience, and there's a lot of interesting research in causality and particularly in consciousness research, because consciousness is another form of microscopic behavior, collective behavior, which is driving the neurons in a very certain way. And again, it's the same thing. So, and then there's a concept in computer neuroscience called causal emergence. That's an information theoretical metric that quantifies the emergence or reduction between micro and macroscale behaviors of a system by evaluating mutual information between its unconstrained repertoire of a possible cause and a specific state of possible effect. Probably nobody knows what I'm talking about. And then I didn't understand it at all when I first read it. All right, so if you understand it, I'm going to just show you this. So, this, again, is 3x3 by binary pixel, scale 1. And then if you think about this as a system, so each component of the system, 300x300, can take either 0 or 1. So this system could take a total of 2 to the power of 90,000 states, 300x300, so because it's a binary image. So this particular image is one of the 2 to the 90,000 states of the system. So, and then this particular picture has some specific probability distribution. This is a 0 over 80%, and then 1 probably about less than 20% at that. And then based on this, you can create some of the most unbiased, the most unconstrained state of a system, which is this. Basically, you have a 50% probability of 0, 50% probability of 1, uniform probability. And then if you know something about the Bayes theorem, this is basically max ent, maximum entropy, not entropy method. So from this, you can calculate how much information is generated from here to here. And then you can calculate by mutual information. It's a little bit, again, non-intuitive, because we're looking at the macro scale and micro scale in a vertical axis. And you can you'll calculate mutual information between scales. So, and you can also calculate the channel capacity C between coils X1 and effect Y1. And you can do it in all the scale. This is scale 2, scale 3, scale 4, scale 5, scale 6. And then you can do with some kind of a causal architecture analysis. The causal emergence is defined as the mutual information at the macro scale minus mutual information at the micro scale. And then this y-axis is the mutual information, and the x-axis is the scale, from micro scale to macro scale. If the causal emergence is negative, meaning that the information generated is actually much higher at the micro scale than macro scale, that means that it's upper causation. And the macro scale behavior is actually reduction. It's called a causal reduction. But if the causal emergence is positive, meaning the downward causation, it's a downward causation because there's more information over here, and the information goes down. So the macroscale behavior is emergence, and that's why it's called a causal emergence. So you can apply the same kind of causal architecture analysis to our data. And I want to expand it to dynamics, and I just made it to binary data, because again, even as a binary data, we're working on an enormous amount of a number. So I just make it binary, And then you're going to expand it to dynamic, because we're talking about the time-dependent dynamics. So again, just to take one time frame, and then t equals t1, and then it has a specific probability distribution, and then it calls x the same size, t equals t1, and it creates this uniformly random distribution of zeros and ones, and create that. And then based on that, you can assign one number for each time frame. For some people, t1, x1. Since this is a binary image, it's easiest to probably just assign binary number. You can just convert a binary number to decimal number as well. And you can do the same as here. So one number here, one number here. And it's just repeated many times up to the last time frame. You have a bunch of numbers over here and a bunch of numbers over here. And you can calculate the mutual information between this large x and large y, and also do the same with the channel capacity. And let's see what happens. So using the same toy model, and then I'm starting with 30 by 30 because again, still we're working on a very high large number because each pixel can be 0 and 1, and a 30 by 30 means that this is each time frame is a manifestation or one state, one specific state out of a 2 to the power of a 900 states. And this is scale 2, scale 3, scale 4, scale 5, and scale 6. And so this is a temporal destination. And I use the same idea for, this is a spatial destination. The same idea to the temporal destination. This is a little easier. You can just do the downsampling, the temporal downsampling by a factor of 2. 400 hertz, 200 hertz, 100 hertz, down to 12 hertz. And then, so this is the average of the 1,000 different initial conditions. So this axis is a temporal scale, and this is a spatial scale. The scale 1 is the original scale, and goes down, and the z-axis is the mutual information in bits. So what we found is that the mutual information peaks at the spatial temporal scale in the Cartesian systemless order. It peaks somewhere. So it's not like, as I showed, it's not like the monotonically going up or monotonically going down. It peaks somewhere in between. So that means that the causal power of the system, the peak causal scale, does not lie in the most microscopic scale or most macroscopic scale. So it's not the simple downward causation or upward causation. So both upward causation and downward causation coexist, which is exactly what we kind of, what I qualitatively explained in an example of the birds. The birds control the collective behavior controls the bird. So the important thing here is that you can quantify in exactly which scale does it lie. So I applied it to clinical data because it was kind of a toy model. So I have 64 basket catheter data, some patients have the data acquisition during a sinus rhythm and atrial fibrillation for 60 seconds. And you can extract the n random samples about the time series of matrix xi with fixed duration, like 4 seconds. Here. You can repeat it for many times because it's 60 seconds data. And then you do some kind of randomization, but again, this is a little bit limited because we have only 64 electrodes. So what I did was that they just reduced the number of the sensors from 64 by a factor of 2 to 32, 16, 8, 4, 2 and 1, and just to pick randomly. Pick the 64, you pick the whole 64. 32, just to pick random 32 electrodes, and 16, 8, 4, 2, 1. So that's iteration number 1. And you can just repeat the process for many times, and as you repeat it for 1,000 times. So this is a temporal destination, starting with 977 hertz, which happens to be the acquisition sampling rate at our institution. And then just this made by a factor of 2, 489 hertz, 244 hertz, and so on. And then, so this is the kind of similar figure that I showed earlier. And let's focus on this one, because this is the most smooth one after 1,000 iterations. So this is the temporal axis, temporal scale axis. This is the spatial scale axis. And the red is the mutual information, and the blue is the channel capacity. And then this is the top row is during the sinus rhythm, and the bottom one is during the atrial fibrillation. And obviously, the causal arches are completely different. So there's the transition of a causality between the sinus rhythm and atrial fibrillation, which makes sense because during sinus rhythm, it's a centrally controlled system with no complex system behavior. Whereas atrial fibrillation, you have some macro scale behavior versus individual behavior. And then, so this is a little bit of a complicated analysis. We can focus on this red dot. So this is sinus rhythm, and this is the atrial fibrillation. So during sinus rhythm, the peak, the temporal scale is about 6. And then the spatial scale is about 6, but it moves during atrial fibrillation to temporal scale of about 4. And then the spatial scale is about probably 5. And then if you go back to this slide, for example, temporal scale 4 is about 122 hertz. So what does this mean? And well, I talked to a couple of people, and then 122 hertz, which is usually about the 8 milliseconds, 9 milliseconds. So this is a time constant tau of a sodium channel. So maybe related to, and there's something related, it's causally related to the recovery of the sodium channel being in the atrial fibrillation. It's a little bit knowing too to find out what the scale the spatial scale means. For example, the peak is around scale 4, meaning that you have a sparse sensing. Probably average distance between different electrodes in scale 4 or 5 is probably a couple centimeters. So meaning that that's a kind of a unit of the causal, the peak causality. In new computational neuroscience, they call it the causal unit of consciousness. So for example, usually in consciousness, in the literature, they say that it consists of about the 100 neurons. So that creates a kind of minimum unit of consciousness, minimum unit of this collective behavior.
Are you binarizing the...
that point? No, so this is, I'm using it, the unipolar data. So. The collocation is a little bit different, essentially the same concept, but I'm creating some kind of the neutron information and the channel capacity for continuous variables. But the equations are the same.
Okay.
Right. All right, so the same take-home message. Sorry, I just kind of have to run it through it. So this is echo measurements. I particularly thank my supervisors, Hugh Calkins from Berger and Henry Alpern, and Doran Schmessler, Johns Hopkins. And then my collaborators are in Bordeaux, Michelle Hassegger, Valeria Zucini, and Olivier Brunner. Thank you so much.
Can you go back to the again, the take home message again?
Which one? So again, the idea is to try to develop some kind of a metric that you can apply at any scale, this is one idea to borrow from computational neuroscience, and then there's a little bit the anointing component in information theory, but I think it's very useful. For example, again, I'm going to have to get to this. So how useful it is in clinically? Because that's a question that I have to answer, and then I'm still working on it. In terms of the describing dynamics and understanding the communication on the different parts of the hospital system, I think this is very, very helpful.
So, okay. Can you go back to the slide where you had the decreasing information transfer from the large scale to the small scale with the rotors?
This one.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the way I understand that is that if you have more rotors, right, you have more each rotor or it's attached small piece of spiral wave, a wavelet is controlling one region of the tissue, right? And so now when you go from the large scale to the small scale, you have a loss of information. In the same way that you had the cable, you had discordant alternance, you know, you had a profile where the information went down and then went back up. But, you know, I think that the way to image this is to look at phase maps. And this is what has been developed to look at fibrillation. There's been people who look at data, and then you get the phase of the wave and the amplitude. It gives you number of rotors and spatial organization. It's very telling. So, and the same thing with alternates, you look at the phase of alternates. So these foreign outlines, you would see that it's the phase is changing spatially. And you can recast it in terms of information, but I don't really know what you gain from that. It's not the natural language to look at rotors. It's really the...
Well, my answer to that...
Over transform or different method to image, you know, phase singularities and their spatial organizations.
No, you can't really visualize the rotors in using clinical data. So that's one of the...
Right, so that's certainly a relevant issue. So when you say for noisy data, this might be more useful, maybe, than trying to do phase maps.
Our data are perfectly noiseless.
Yeah. May I offer an opinion rather than a question?
Sure.
I mean, provide an answer to some questions, because I think it's a common theme in many of the questions from many of the colleagues, is related to the fact that Shannon entropy is not exactly intuitive to a modern person.
It's rather counterintuitive.
The more intuitive thing is the Kolmogorov entropy or Kolmogorov complexity, as it is known. So a formal definition is that it's the minimal length of a program that can encode a particular message. Of course, it depends on the language in which you prepare to encode that message. In practical terms, a very common thing to measure the complexity of a message is to zip it and see how long is the zip file. And if the message is simple, then the zip file will be short, even if the original message is long. That's that intuitive understanding. So the Shannon entropy corresponds to a particular sort of encoding, which is most primitive you can imagine. And in particular, so when you send a message and the next symbol is completely independent on the previous, so there is no absolute predictability about what the next letter may be, even if you know all the previous letters. And so the only thing that can allow you to simplify this message is statistics. How many zeros and how many ones are in it?
Not necessarily.
That's what Shannon entropy is. And when you binarize your experimental or numerical picture and gives ones and zeros that may correspond to what you what is practically accessible in clinic, that's quite understandable, and I totally agree with that. Now, when you consider the information transfer, here I'm less sure what does it mean in terms of the Kolmogorov complexity, but I can sort of simplify the situation. Imagine that it is also about a particular way of predicting what happens in the next place if you know what happens in the previous place. And it can be something like that. You expect the next place to be the same as in the previous place, and if it happens, then you have mutual information. And if it is not the same, then you don't have much information. That would explain that picture with discordant antennas, because in the next place it's opposite to what you did in the previous. So there is no correlation at all. Although for an intelligent person, there is absolute correlation, absolute predictability. You just need to apply a slightly more complicated algorithm of predicting what's the next place compared to the previous. Just slightly more complicated.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the comment.
Yes. So when you're analyzing the spatial temporal pattern, this method of predicting what's there compared to what was here is intuitive and clear and probably quite physiological, because that's how the excitation wave propagates. When you apply it to the information flow between different scales, it's much less intuitive, and I wanted to say, probably requires further thinking.
Thank you for the opinion. So Kolmogorov entropy has been used in describing fibrillation. Particular paper, I think it was Europace 2006, looking at the Kolmogorov entropy and distinguished it, induced ventricular fibrillation versus the spontaneous ventricular fibrillation, and there's significant difference. So in terms of the time series analysis, that's useful. But you're going to have to apply to two dimensions, three dimensions, because we're talking about some kind of a tissue phenomena. So that's a kind of what you need another step to go through. And then, in terms of the previous effect from the previous, for example, the information, the next one. So I showed you that most primitive kind of the metrics, for example, you know, the Shannon entropy and the mutual information. But actually, the transfer entropy in the most previous sense, this is a memorized. So for example, it's not affected by anything other than the one previous one. So this is actually commonly used to quantify the Markovian process. So this is perfect to analyze this. But actually, the original transfer entropy has, you can actually apply a different parameter for the history, time history, to whatever, like, you know, 10 time points or 25, 100 time points. So it's not true that actually it's the simplest form. So you can make it as complex as you want. To us, to make it more clinically useful. For example, if it is affected by, you know, this previous beat, you can incorporate that in your calculation. So it just
What you showed was not that.
Yeah, what I showed was that because I worked on very simplest case. Yes, right. That's right. Yes.
My comment. So when I said the Shannon entropy is rather counterintuitive, that's exactly what I meant, because you would have highest information according to Shannon entropy where you have the highest chaos.
Highest.
So Shannon entropy will be equal to zero where there is synchronization, and in mundane common sense, if there is synchronization, there will be information. Shannon entropy works absolutely opposite to this.
What's wrong with that?
By the definition of Shannon entropy.
Right. Is it just based on definition?
Why, yes. So in this sense, how to say it? It's amazing that we had just a couple of weeks ago. We currently have here at KITP running in parallel quantum thermodynamics program, and we there was discussion with people from the other side, from this quantum thermodynamics. And speaking about synchronization there and what is information there, and the information for cardiac tissue is synchronization. That is kind of what we normally understand. When you apply your Shannon entropy, that is good because you actually, from your point, look for the core where there will be the most of the chaos and the tip. What you call, and for you as a cardiologist, that is the main point, to find where the core is. And,
well,
and
thank you, but...
Now, from this slide, you might have number of rotors. Roman, here we come to your works. Yeah, and these basins of whatever, this mosaic of different rotors, of number of rotors. I never dared to say what might define the size of the basin of a rotor. It might be actually size of the response function.
Because
when rotors come close to each other, they have a strong interaction, and they, in this way, you might have what you call multiple rotors, and there will be no information because that is exactly the maximum Shannon entropy for each coinciding with the size of the response function.
Right. So, I don't want to...
Describing the same phenomenon.
Get hung up
indeed,
too much
there
on the...
no spiral, what you call spiral wave, the regions of synchronization.
Yeah, thank you. But the, I don't want to get too much hung up on the Shannon entropy because I used it to just introduce the communication metrics like just the mutual information and the transfer entropy, but I completely understand that the counterintuitive nature of the Shannon entropy. And the Shannon entropy has been used to try to localize orders and, you know, people in this field as well, looking at the two-dimensional and three-dimensional the model data. But that doesn't really work when you have a multiple rotors, for example, multiple state phase singularity. I showed that in my paper, in the previous paper last year. So it's a little bit the superficial the argument, because we're not trying to find a phase singularity, but we're trying to quantify the communication network, the whole system, try to understand a macroscopic behavior. So. I completely understand the point, but I don't want to just get hung up on some particular metrics.
On that note, we'll reconvene in 10 minutes, 10:45.